Our first merits argument will be Virginia Board of Medicine versus Dr. Hogman, Ms. Barrett, and Dr. Rodriguez. Ms. Barrett, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve it? Although you're responsible for keeping track of your time, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
You may begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Erin Barrett on behalf of the Virginia Board of Medicine. We're asking this court to reverse the ruling of the circuit court and reinstate the board order revoking the license of Dr. Hogman. We're asking for this based on the circuit court's impermissible expansion of both the right to counsel provided in statute and the due process notice requirement for administrative proceedings. Neither expansion of due process rights is supported by existing law. Both will affect administrative process and procedure for all agencies of the Commonwealth. The circuit court here issued what amounts to a bright-line rule that any time a respondent's attorney is unavailable for a hearing, an administrative agency must grant a continuance. This removes the discretion from the panel chair, and theoretically, agencies must grant continuances in perpetuity or risk violating a respondent's due process rights.
Does it actually go further than that? It's not just if the counsel is actually unavailable, just if he claims he's unavailable.
Exactly. If counsel states he's unavailable, then the panel chair can't use his discretion to determine the validity of that or to review any other considerations.
Counsel, explain the standard here. What is the standard in terms of is it a due process right or is it a continuance?
Well, it is a continuance, but a continuance can, of course, affect a due process right. In terms of the standard, because this is a constitutional issue, it would be reviewed de novo, but at the administrative level, the panel chair has discretion to review all of the factors presented to him to determine if a continuance is granted.
Well, I'm going to ask Dr. Rodriguez the same question, but is every denial of a continuance automatically a due process violation?
No, it is not. The Supreme Court has made that very clear, that there are times when a continuance cannot be granted and a respondent or petitioner is not, their due process rights are not infringed. Specifically, a denial of a continuance request based on attorney unavailability does not on its own constitute a due process violation. The review here under the Supreme Court case law states that the reviewing court must consider all the factors as a whole that were presented to the tribunal at the time that the decision was made. Those factors as a whole were never considered here. The circuit court clearly stated that once Dr. Hagman's counsel stated he was unavailable, the panel chair should not have looked beyond that.
Judge Ellis seemed to rely on the fact that since the license had been summarily suspended, there was no real danger to the patients of the Commonwealth because during the period that the hearing was pending, there was no treatment of patients occurring. Would you comment on how that should have played into the judge's determination and why that's not a good reason for saying, even if the Commonwealth couldn't go forward in October, well, then just say, okay, if you want a continuance, it's going to go into 2016 and not be heard in 2015.
Well, there's an argument there that the evidence and witness memories, aside from the fact that the witnesses likely would not have been able to attend anything beyond the summer of 2015 with any certainty, there's an argument that the evidence becomes stale, the witnesses fail to remember, on top of the fact that the allegations in this case were quite damning. And the witnesses...
Whose burden was that to show?
That was the Commonwealth's burden. However, when the panel chair was reviewing this for whether or not to grant or deny a continuance, the panel chair only had what was submitted to him. He couldn't go into a determination on the credibility of the evidence that was going to be before the panel. He just had what was before him. And going back to Judge Russell's question, is that the evidence could have become stale by the time February 2016 or later rolled around. And there's some argument that the public is damaged by not moving forward with some quickness, although not so much quickness as to violate
even though the license was suspended.
Even though the license was suspended, Your Honor, because that was a summary decision and that wasn't based on evidence that was going to be presented to the board.
But the danger would be that doctor practicing. And if the license is suspended, the doctor's not practicing.
Well, the panel chair did have some, at least an allegation in front of him, that some of the actions that Dr. Hagman had been taking with his license, which were teaching these classes, were continuing.
Is that the practice of medicine, teaching the classes?
that would have been up to the panel to decide, and that was never raised to the panel.
Well, if it wasn't raised to the panel at any point, I mean, isn't there a problem with then assuming that it is a practice of medicine? I mean, there is no dispute that he was not treating patients during the period of suspension. Is that correct?
As far as I'm aware, there is no evidence of that, correct. However, that goes to the substantive allegations that were before the board and does not really relate to the constitutional due process issue of whether denial of a continuance request violates a petitioner's due process right to counsel.
But whether to grant the continuance or not almost necessarily involves some level of balancing, doesn't it?
It does. And in this case, the circuit court had an issue with the panel chair considering any arguments whatsoever from the Commonwealth. If Dr. Hagman had requested this continuance and the Commonwealth had not objected, the continuance would have been granted. The difference here is that the Commonwealth had very specific objections that the Commonwealth submitted to the panel chair.
Did the Commonwealth object to the first continuance request?
No, the Commonwealth did not object to the first continuance request that was granted in March, immediately following his summary suspension. The Commonwealth only objected once the second continuance request was made in May for the hearing that was held in June.
And that would have put it forward to a new calendar year.
There was
no other opportunity to argue this before the board.
The next scheduled hearing dates for the board were in October 2015 for their general hearing dates. They could not guarantee that Dr. Hagman could have been placed on that docket. Additionally, the Commonwealth argued that their witnesses would not have been available at that time. The board tried to partially accommodate both the Commonwealth and the appellee in this case by trying to gather a panel for an August hearing. However, they could not gather enough panel members to meet the statutory requirement to hold a formal administrative hearing. So there was space on the June docket, and the board, although the circuit court specifically dismissed this as a consideration, the board does have to take its schedule into account. It's made up of volunteer members. They have a limited hearing schedule that is very public and published 2 years in advance, and they had to consider that when considering whether to grant or deny a continuance.
So, and you argue that the Commonwealth would have been prejudiced because a number of the witnesses by that fall, even in October, would not necessarily have been able, because of their military commitments or whatever, wouldn't have been available. Is that right?
That's what the Commonwealth argued to the panel chair, and that's what the panel chair partially relied on when he issued his decision, his denials of the second continuance request and the renewal of that request.
Go over the factual findings that were made at the board level relating to the continuance.
There were no factual findings at the continuance level, Your Honor. The only factual findings in the board order relate to the substantive evidence that was presented to the board.
So is that a problem?
No, Your Honor, because the board has to decide the case based on the allegations that are presented to it. There is no finding in the actual board order that addresses continuance requests or pre-hearing decisions, such as evidentiary rulings. Those come up on the circuit court level on appeal.
So you're saying the circuit court can make factual findings?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the factual findings regarding the substantive allegations before the board had nothing to do with the request for continuance.
But implicit in the board's granting or denial of a continuance, it makes some determination, given that you've acknowledged that there's a balancing test. Is there any requirement that the board explain the basis for denying the continuance?
There is no stated requirement under case law or statute for explaining the basis of the denial of a continuance request.
Well, if it comes to us on a silent record, is it the burden of the party who got the continuance or who is challenging the decision below to demonstrate error?
It would be the responsibility of the party challenging the decision below. And again, when this comes to you, although you are looking, the intent of the Supreme Court cases in this matter, governing cases of this sort, is that reviewing courts review everything as a whole. A different tribunal can come to a different conclusion regarding what they would have done on a continuance request. That doesn't mean this violated constitutionality. The circuit court clearly believed that he would have granted the continuance, but that was the wrong way to look at this matter. What he should have done was look at everything that was presented to the panel chair and determine whether, given the circumstances as a whole, the panel chair made a decision that was unreasoned or arbitrary. The panel chair stated his reasons for the decision, and it was not arbitrary. Therefore, the...
Well, aren't those reasons essentially factual findings, that the Commonwealth would have been prejudiced, that one continuance had already been granted, that 6 weeks was more than sufficient time, and in fact that allegations have been known for a little bit longer than 6 weeks, or at least that there was an issue, because that's how we got the first continuance?
Well, I would argue they're not factual findings, Your Honor. They are discretionary findings of the panel chair, but they are not factual findings before the administrative...
What authority do you have for that position?
They do not...
What case authority do you have for that?
For the statement that continuance request is not a factual finding? It's a procedural matter?
That the pieces that the board relied on are matter of law and not factual finding.
I don't have any case law as I stand here today.
But, I mean, if hypothetically, if a board chair says, having considered the arguments placed in front of me, I find that the Commonwealth's witnesses are only available on this date, we've already accommodated a person with multiple continuances, the board has to go forward at this time, to do otherwise would prejudice the Commonwealth's ability. And I recognize that's a hypothetical and not this case. Why isn't that a factual finding that the Commonwealth would be prejudiced? I mean, it seems to me that that would benefit you greatly if that was a factual finding that neither the circuit court nor this court could touch.
Well, then I guess I could argue that it was a factual finding. I would like to touch briefly on the notice issue, because that is another assignment of error before this court. Dr. Hagman had sufficient notice for his formal hearing. He was, as has mentioned, he was summarily suspended in March. The board issued a notice for a hearing in April. He was granted his first continuance request. At the time he was sent the first notice, he was sent the majority of the Commonwealth's exhibits that were entered into evidence against him at the hearing. That was actually 14 weeks in advance of when the hearing actually took place. Now, because his continuance request was granted the first time, he was issued another notice of hearing 6 weeks prior to the date that included one small exhibit that was never the subject of the appellee's request for continuance, and that was 6 weeks in advance of the actual hearing date. He had the balance of the evidence 14 weeks in advance of this hearing.
Was the argument ever made to the board that, not to the circuit court, but to the board, that they needed more time to evaluate the evidence?
That was made in the request for renewal of the second continuance request. So the first continuance request stated attorney unavailability, and I believe that they hoped to gather more evidence from the university at issue. When that was denied...
You said first continuance request. You mean the first...
I mean the first second continuance request. Yes, excuse me. When that was renewed for the second continuance after the first denial, then it was added in as a reason.
You can use your time how you wish, but you are into your rebuttal time.
Okay, I will save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Dr. Rodriguez, nice to see you.
Thank you, sir.
You may begin when ready.
Ramon Rodriguez, counsel for Dr. Hagman. With respect to the Board of Medicine's arguments, we are not arguing, Dr. Hagman is not arguing, that there's a specific issue with regard to the decision that the committee chair, Dr. O'Connor, arrived at. Specifically, the argument that the position that Dr. Hagman has relates to what appears to be inherent bias based on the first letter that he received upon his request for a continuance. Had the panel chair simply stated, I don't believe there's grounds for a continuance, and left it at that, the assumption would have been he stated for whatever reason he has, and arguably those are probably factual determinations. However, thereafter he provided additional commentary where he said, well, I don't think that there's factual evidence.
Give it to you one,
but I wouldn't give it. Yes, sir. And so the issue there has to do with knowing that any decision that the committee chair is rendering with respect to requests for continuances appear to have, or at least have the appearance of there being bias in the decision and the rationale in which the matter is moving.
Counsel, let me just get this straight. So what you're saying is you would not have taken issue over the denial of that second continuance had the chair not made comments into the record for the basis?
We wouldn't have taken issue with respect to the concern regarding bias and the request to recuse the council chair. Certainly, there are still procedural grounds based on 14th Amendment claims. Why counsel was still not available, Dr. Hagman was still not available. There was a voluminous record in excess of 3,000 pages. There was evidence in that record that was provided by the board that material was missing that was likely material to the case as opposed to an immaterial or irrelevant fact. Specifically,
a lot of the argument you're making now really goes to your assignments of cross error, which is fine, and you can use your 15 minutes how you wish, but that seems to me that you're almost ceding the ground on which Judge Ellis gave you relief, because, I mean, our questions, at least initially, are more directed to the decision to not grant the continuance.
Certainly. So the decision to not grant continuance, in our position is that it was an abuse of the chair's discretion based on the balancing test that Your Honor mentioned.
But the standard for the question I asked that I said I would ask you, I will ask you now. The mere denial of a continuance request, especially a second continuance request, is not automatically a due process violation. The board has discretion to deny those requests in the normal course, and they are entitled to some level of deference, factual findings, etc.
Not from the constitutional aspect, Your Honor.
Counsel, I guess the point is, how does it rise to a constitutional question?
It rises to a constitutional question when the decision maker, in this case the panel chair, has disregarded or didn't properly balance the factual allegations or concerns that were raised.
I have to ask you on that then, because you've already gotten one continuance, and then the reason for the next continuance is that his counsel, you at the time, had another commitment. And there's no absolute requirement that you be his counsel at that hearing, correct?
That is correct, but if I may, the initial continuance request was an unrepresented defendant, Dr. Hagman, not having counsel, and after a year and 13-month investigation, suddenly being informed that he's subject to a summary order of suspension. Therefore, he requested a continuance. Thereafter, sought retention of counsel. At the time of the Commonwealth's response to Dr. Hagman's initial request, they indicated that a continuance was granted, and there was no indication.
The first continuance request.
Yes, sir, the first continuance request. For a hearing that was in April, which is not a scheduled time for the board to meet regularly. They meet February, July, and October.
But you don't dispute that the time after the first continuance, the doctor had the opportunity to hire counsel before the setting of the actual hearing.
And he did.
Right.
So he retained counsel.
But you had the commitment on that date to be somewhere else. Is that correct already? And that was one reason you gave, and the other reason was that he was going to be out of the country.
Yes, sir.
And how do you respond to Commonwealth's argument, well, your commitment was one you chose to be at another event that was not related to this case, of course, and second, that he bought his tickets to leave the country after he was notified of the date?
Well, conversely, he was not notified of the date prior to the purchase of the tickets, and the specific date that the Commonwealth was having that the Board of Medicine was having the hearing was not on notice when counsel was retained.
But according to you, you had at least a good idea, because unless the board a special session of the board was set, we knew the dates July and October were the next two times the board was going to sit. I mean, that's known ahead of time.
June and October, yes.
June and October, excuse me. And so, and so that's known, so to say, well, he didn't have knowledge of when the hearing was going to be. Well, you kind of do, unless it's going to be a special non-regular session of the board, don't you? Doesn't the board meet the same day? I mean, isn't the board's schedule of hearings, the February, June, October, isn't that known ahead of time?
Those meetings are known ahead of time, yes, Your Honor. However, the board convened a hearing in April to accommodate or to set the initial order of suspension.
Setting aside the extra comment from the board chair, would the potential of the Commonwealth losing the witnesses because of various military commitments scattering to the winds, evidence becoming stale, is that a factor that the board can use in determining whether to grant a continuance? I mean, that seems to be a very normal reason why in the criminal context the continuances are denied all the time.
The issue, however, is that the board didn't verify whether or not there was going to be unavailability of witnesses or whether the witnesses could have testified by other means. Well, they didn't check. They just simply assumed that they would be unavailable.
Did they verify your schedule?
They verified... Well, no, sir, they did not.
Okay. And did you provide any actual proof other than assertion, much like the board did? I mean, it seems to me we had competing levels of assertion, and the board treated the representations of the two lawyers equally. They credited both versions of the defense and says we balance these versions and are worried about the staleness of the witnesses given that we've already granted one continuance. I mean, you weren't put under oath. Their witnesses weren't put under oath. I understand that, but isn't that kind of normally how we deal with continuance requests? It's almost we expect the lawyers as officers of the court to accurately inform us of these things.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there are other aspects that the board would have had to have, or the board chair should have considered that weigh heavier than the possibility that witnesses maybe in October, perhaps not in February.
Were those things brought to the board's attention, whatever things you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so is it fair to say that the board considered those things? If something is brought to the attention of the board and the record doesn't prove otherwise, can't we assume that the board heard what counsel was saying and took those things into consideration?
I can't make that assumption. I can only assume that the
Well, you're board assuming it for the things that are in your client's favor, so we have to assume it.
My assumption is that the board chair would have, when he read correspondence that documented unavailability, that he would have presumably taken that into consideration.
And the concept, I know it's not lost on you, given your firm history, that military commitments for lawyers or witnesses actually can impact schedules pretty significantly and lead to the request for continuances or make rescheduling things almost impossible. I mean, that's not an irrational thing for the... Given that we are dealing with a substantial number of military witnesses who do not have control over their own schedules, rescheduling things is very difficult, as any lawyer who practices in the firm you've practiced in knows.
Rescheduling is difficult. It's not impossible. Permissive leave in most circumstances is generally granted. And there are other means by which the board could obtain the witness testimony that would have been able to have been presented at the hearing. And the Administrative Procedure Act, which the board follows, accommodates those specific requests, as an example of the Bene Esse deposition.
So there was at least 14 weeks, though, of notice for most of the evidence that you needed to be on notice about. There was some that was given 6 weeks before, is that right?
Dr. Hagman would have had 14 weeks notice of the information.
You didn't until he hired you.
Yes.
And you were hired on what day? Excuse me. Refresh my memory.
I don't have... I believe I was hired at the end of April, but I do not have an independent recollection of the very specific day.
But as far as the substance of what was in the notice, Ms. Barrett's represented that there was only one very small exhibit that didn't, at least from her description, it didn't seem like it changed the nature or character of the proceedings. Do you agree with that characterization, that the notice in 6 weeks was essentially the same as the 14-week notice, the difference being you and not the character and quality of the notice?
And the extent of the information that was in that tenth binder of information. But looking at the size of the other nine volumes, the tenth volume is significantly smaller than the preceding nine that had been forwarded by the board.
And counsel, we've sort of taken you to the appellant's issues because we wanted your responses on a variety of things so we could get a handle on the issues. But I know you've got several cross errors, so if you'd like to address any of those in particular.
And Dr. Rodriguez, I will give you an extra 2 minutes on your cross error and then give Ms. Barrett an extra 2 minutes to respond to the cross error.
Thank you. With respect to the balancing that Your Honors had previously mentioned that the Board of Medicine was doing, the requirement for the court is to have the availability or the meaningful ability to appear, the meaningful ability to have counsel present. Specifically, when Dr. Hagman's request, when the court stated, the lower court stated that Dr. Hagman's inability to attend because he was trans-Pacific did not constitute a valid reason. The issue in that respect is that the...
Does the record reveal the purpose of the trans-Pacific trip?
I'm sorry,
Does
Your Honor?
Does the record reveal why he was taking the trip?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. It was a multi-generational family reunion in Japan, which had been planned a year in advance. And it would have been with excessive, in addition to the monetary aspects of needing to make the change when he was trans-Pacific, there would have also been significant domestic issues that likely would have arisen had he come back to attend. That doesn't go to the, it also goes to the point.
Domestic is within his family.
Yes, Your Honor. The lower court likened it to a birthday party and mischaracterized the nature of the specific event.
He would have been back if originally on the date of the hearing, but having flown from Japan, arriving on the date of the hearing. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. But it would have been on the day of the hearing, but beyond the time for him to actually appear.
That's the jet lag, certainly. Okay.
Furthermore, with respect to the doctor's inability to attend and counsel's inability to attend, the board disallowed their ability to confront the witnesses that were brought against them to call their own witnesses or to prepare their own case.
Well, but in fairness, it was a choice that the doctor made not to appear at the hearing.
He wasn't barred from appearing.
It was a choice.
It was a choice.
Yes,
and it was also a choice not to have a different attorney appear on his behalf.
Yes, that was a choice.
That was a choice.
However, with respect to a different attorney appearing on
I understand his, you're saying it's a constitutional matter, but it was a choice, correct?
It was a choice. It was a constitutional matter in with respect to we didn't have sufficient time to prepare for the matter based on the volume of evidence. So to retain it...
But that goes to you being hired at the end of April as opposed to when the initial allegation was made, correct? I mean, any lack of preparation that stems from a delay in hiring counsel isn't chargeable to the board. It's chargeable to Dr. Hagman, isn't it?
It is, but one doesn't know what difficulties one encounters while retaining counsel. And counsel for board matters is more specific than general counsel.
But if, for instance, he'd waited a week before the hearing to hire counsel, then counsel saying, I can't be ready in a week is not... That wouldn't be a valid reason for a continuance, correct?
Clearly, and that's not the facts of this case.
Well right, but it's a continuum, and we have to move up and down. And I think you would concede that the board, at least in general, when it's doing the balancing, is entitled to at least some discretion in setting a continuance. I mean, that's Haugen versus DSS.
They are entitled to some discretion. However, the issue rests with the choices that they made were in violation of the Dr. Hagman's constitutional protections, specifically relating to the amount of time and his ability to prepare.
Let me ask you, if you weren't retained till the end of April, and the six-week notice is not that much long after that, it was then clear that you could not be there as counsel, you hadn't had much time to prepare by that point anyway. If you informed him you could not be there because of a prior commitment, why could he not hire other counsel with almost as much prep time as you had?
Your Honor, I think the issue has to do with the amount of prep time. There wasn't sufficient prep time based on the information that the board presented.
You waited until the end of April to hire even you.
Again, the issue is with respect to 6 weeks. 6 weeks wasn't a sufficient amount of time, and regardless of who we would have hired and would have been available.
Would 14 weeks have been sufficient time? Because, I mean, that's when the majority of the case was laid out, correct?
The majority of the case was laid out at that time. I believe that may have been sufficient time, but again, may not. I can't speculate in that regard.
Having seen the allegations, you don't know whether a credible defense could have been put together in 14 weeks?
Well, there are other issues in addition to the issue of credible defense. There are also the ability to call witnesses, and presumably those witnesses who are also members of the military and active duty would face the same problems that arguably the board's witnesses allegedly faced in June.
Thank you, Dr. Rodriguez.
Thank you.
Ms. Barrett, and we're adding two more minutes to your time.
A couple points I wanted to touch on very briefly, and I'll be brief about this. Regarding the notice, going back to that, the circuit court here, and I think this has been buried a little bit, tied the constitutional notice to the length of an administrative investigation, which is affected by outside factors, including actions of the respondent and actions of other witnesses. Dr. Hagman was aware of this investigation while it was going on, and as the board has stated on brief, participated in partially stretching out the amount of investigation. No case law currently exists that ties the length of an administrative investigation to constitutionally sufficient notice. This court and the Supreme Court of Virginia have not stated any rule requiring that. Regarding the counsel has brought up Devenne essay depositions as a substitute for live witness testimony, and although those are permitted under the APA, a board isn't required to make use of them. The Board of Medicine regularly interacts with witnesses on the stand, asks its own questions once the Commonwealth and the Respondents' Counsel have asked questions, and there's no guarantee that a panel chair would agree to admit Devenne essay deposition transcripts in place of live witness testimony, and that again goes back to the discretion of the panel chair. Addressing Dr. Hagman's additional assignments of error, Dr. Hagman stated his unavailability only after his initial request for a second continuance. He never explained the delay in that statement. It seems like a fairly big deal that the respondent cannot attend a hearing, but he never addressed that, and he never truly answered the panel chair's questions of his underlying documents that supported his alleged unavailability.
How do you respond to Mr. Rodriguez's argument that, Dr. Rodriguez's argument that that the board chair essentially said it wouldn't matter?
I believe that was just an artful drafting. The panel chair attempted to provide reasons behind it, to provide full transparency of why the request was denied. And in doing that, apparently, he has come under fire for laying out his reasons.
Well, if one of his reasons is he wasn't getting one no matter what, that's a problem.
And I don't agree that it has to be read that way. I believe that if you look at the ruling, the statement is that there was not good cause shown here. However, what he probably intended to say was that the Commonwealth presented these objections that outweigh the concerns that have been raised by respondent.
We have to deal with a record that exists, and he said what he said. So the question is, from a legal perspective, what effect does that have?
And again, from a legal perspective, I would state that it doesn't matter here in terms of whether Appley's constitutional due process rights were violated. Because looking, again, at the situation as a whole, as it was presented to the panel chair, the decision itself did not violate his due process right to retain counsel.
So we don't look at all at what he said. We just look at the ultimate decision.
You can look
at, we look at the record to see if it supports that decision.
As long as everything is being looked at in context and as a whole, rather than what the circuit court did, which is individually pull out factors and state, this should not have been reviewed. This did not matter. I would not have looked at this. That's where it goes beyond a de novo review and into insertion of discretion.
But on the due process...
Well, wait a minute. They don't... Is your position that the circuit court conducts a de novo review?
The circuit court on appeal of a constitutional issue for APA
cases... Oh, okay,
cases,
on the legal issue.
Yes,
okay.
De novo review.
But on the... At some point, a board chair could be so biased as that fact alone, even if they're a neutral person could come to the same conclusion that that would be a due process problem. One of the due process rights is a neutral and impartial fact finder, correct?
Correct.
And I guess it's the Commonwealth's position that despite what at best is an inartful statement, the record does not rise to that level?
It does not. The appellee moved for recusal of the panel chair, and the panel chair voted by statute to retain the panel chair at the hearing, looking at all these documents. All of these documents were submitted to the remainder of the panel. They voted unanimously to retain him. And that is the statutory procedure for
recusal.
How
many were on the panel?
I believe 8 total, including the panel chair, so perhaps 7 voted to retain him. And I see that I'm out of time, so in conclusion, I will ask that this court overturn the circuit court decision and reinstate the board order. Thank you.
Consistent with the court's traditions, we'll come down and read.